This gentleman here, we were very fortunate to receive in the mail here. They had sent us a copy of his book, Late at Night, a memoir. And it tells an incredible tale of his career in the recording business and also, of course, as an actor as well. And really some of the things that he was dealing with behind the scenes, a lot of personal issues and a lot of things that I think are shocking people as he's making this book tour and exposing some of the details of his life and really kind of leveraging some of the details of his life to try to tell a story and to try to help people dealing with similar issues. I speak, of course, of the one and only Rick Springfield. Rick, it's a pleasure to have you on the FDH Lounge. How are you tonight, sir?
I'm good. Thanks a lot.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to have you on the show here. There's some things, obviously, we want to get to with your book and some of the things that really kind of shaped you. I like to start in more of a broad type of area to start with here. I'm somebody who's always kind of been fascinated by Australia. I've never been there, but I've really kind of developed what I thought was kind of a feel for it, really, and then I read your book and found some kind of interesting things. I see a lot of similarities between the countries as far as the informality of the people relative to some of the older cultures of Europe and Asia. But some things you talk about in the book are some of the more hardscrabble edges to Australia, really going beyond the kind of outlaw beginnings of the country, but all of the poisonous animals and fish and plants there and the toughness of the people. Am I wrong to see similarities between the peoples here, or are they really kind of different as far as when you get right down to it, as far as the makeup of them?
No, there's a lot of similarities. Actually, they... Americans and Aussies get along really well. They are very similar in a lot of ways. They had kind of similar beginnings, you know, the struggle to, you know, to win in the country, and I mean, we're both colonials, you know.
Yeah, I've always kind of been fascinated by it. It just seems like such a an interesting place, and you paint such a vivid picture of what it was like to grow up there, really starting in the post-war years of your youth and some of the travels that you've done. And it was kind of interesting also too that Australia, like America, having that lineage from England, you actually going over to England during your youth and coming back and initially at some point being mistaken as a British person there, because again, you, as you described it in the book, you were a little bit more mod than some of the people you came back to in Australia in the early 60s.
Yeah, it was Australia was way behind the times, and when I came back in 1963, they've caught up now. It's an amazing place now, but back then it was an eastern country surrounded by the East. It was very, very disturbing to me as a young hip would-be English boy coming back to what was then a very, very retro, very old-fashioned, very mom-dad culture.
And so clearly you were somebody that had exposure to and knowledge of some of the different cultures here prior to your career really taking off in America as it did right around the turn of the 80s here. The stretch in Vietnam also, when you were playing in some rock bands there for some of the troops by the front lines, those were some really interesting parts of the book as well. But this battle with depression that really forms kind of the core of your book and the core of the message of what you went through. Talk about how that manifested itself really during your formative years and leading up to that breakthrough that you had in the early 80s.
It first really manifested itself. The beginning of the book starts out with me hanging myself in my parents' garden shed at 16. That was really kind of my introduction to depression. Thankfully, it didn't work. The rope came untangled, but I was very committed and was, you know, hanging there for about 20 seconds before the rope came loose. It's been with me ever since. It's also been part of my driver too. I mean, I believe with everything that comes, equal good and equal bad. So it was. It's been part of the thing that's made me such a driven person with my career. I really thought success would heal me, you know, would make it all go, all the bad stuff go away, and it did for a while. But it, you know, it settled back, and I had to deal with it internally.
Mm-hmm. Well, you speak in the book of in more recent years some of the lyrics that you've had and some of them being kind of raw and kind of painful and some of the kind of confessional type things that you've been writing as far as music. But obviously, a book like this goes far beyond that. What was your process essentially of kind of conditioning yourself for this kind of really unprecedented level of just kind of letting it all hang out as far as what you'd been through? Did you find it to be really difficult, or did you find, you know, that the path of your career in recent years with some of the lyrics that you've done, did you find that that was kind of, you know, softening it up for you a little bit mentally?
Actually, writing it, I've always wanted to write it for the last, like, 10 years, because I know I've had a really interesting life. I know there's a lot of lessons I've learned there that people can associate with. But the writing of it was really fun. I mean, I wrote it without a ghostwriter, so it was, I just launched into it and started. It was really, most of it was enjoyable going back through my life. There was some painful moments, and I had to decide how deep I was going to go, but I decided I either tell it or I don't, you know, and I'm not going to sugarcoat it or try and make myself likable or appear any other way other than who I am. So I'm truthful in songs. I just had to lay it out a little more clearly in the book.
Well, the honesty is really very stark. I think there's no question about that, and particularly in some of the latter parts of the book where you speak of some of the things and that you were confessing to regarding your wife Barbara and some of the things that she'd been through over time. Do you have any kind of sense that, because again, you had met her, it seems, very early on in your fame. Do you think you would have run into these issues regardless, or do you think that when somebody blows up as much as you did back in the day here, inevitably there's going to be some sense for a lot of people of wild oats to sow? Do you get the sense if you'd met her after you'd got a chance to act some of that out that it might have been smoother, or do you think that it would have probably gone the same either way?
I think it might have been worse, actually. We met before anything happened with me. We met in 1979, just before Working Class Dog was released before I was cast on General Hospital. She was responsible for a lot of that. Mm-hmm. You know, she gave me the courage to be brave. You know, to do things that I might not have, you know, had the courage to do. She's very, very much a part of my life, and I don't think it would have been the same if I had met her later. I don't think I certainly wouldn't have had a successful life, because she's my rock and keeps me. You know, I'm the one that flits around the rock, and she's just the steady hand in my life, and I absolutely need that.
Well, that's very interesting to contemplate that. Well, when you were breaking out back then, you know, in that whole 79, 80, 81, 82 period there, as far as it went, it was very interesting when I saw another interview you'd done recently. You mentioned about how early on, what were you making? I guess it was $500 bucks initially was your pay for General Hospital. They ended up bringing you in at a fairly low scale at that point, but it didn't take you a lot of time, it seems, to get the upper hand on them once your career took off with the music.
Yeah, it didn't take long, and I wasn't into it. I mean, once the music thing started happening, I wasn't. And you know, the General Hospital wasn't about money; it was about exposure. So, we instead of asking for more money, we just asked for more time off so I could tour more. Even at the end of when I left General Hospital, I was still only making like $600 a show.
Mm-hmm. It was, you know, and yet it's very interesting because, you know, you spoke about it in the book at some length, the whole nature of coming back to the show after a couple of decades away, after about 22 years or so in that role, and reminiscing with characters who you'd done scenes with back in the day as well, that you'd said that really only in the world of soap operas could something like that happen, and it just almost seems surreal the way you were describing it.
Yeah, it was pretty weird. I went back for about about another 18 months. I think about the same length as my first stint. And it's a lot of work. Soap operas are really, really hard to do. It's a lot of line memorization. It's a long day, you know, and they don't get paid as much as the nighttime people, and they work much harder. Actually, everybody does. The writers, the producers, the directors. Everybody works their butt off on a soap. But since I did Californication, I'm looking to do more nighttime stuff too now. Now that the writing's getting so good on TV, especially on cable shows.
Yeah. I mean, with Californication and everything else, yeah, it's really provided a platform for you to be able to expand your acting. An obligatory question when interviewing you. You talked about this in your book and kind of coming to grips with the notion of Jesse's girl, and ultimately when the time comes, and hopefully far down the road, but when an obituary's getting written here, obviously that's going to come pretty high in there. You seem to have come to grips with that, with the notion that is going to be pretty high up in there, and you know that's going to be one of the primary things clearly that you're known for musically.
It's really taken on a life of its own. There's no other song that I've had that's really comparable to the life that this one song has taken on, and it's just the luck of the draw. I'm proud to have a song that's done that. I mean, writers hope for that, you know, to have one song that will probably live on beyond them, you know. And I wouldn't have picked that one in my wildest dreams. I just thought it was a good album cut, but it seemed to have struck a chord for sure.
Well, ultimately, in music and in other fields, sometimes the things that you least expect will kind of take on a life of their own. Rick, I know that you're very busy with your book tour going on. I know we only had you for a limited window tonight. I appreciate you being on. We always give our guests a chance to plug at the end here. I know there were some materials that were sent to us by your people. Obviously, you've got a lot going on at rickspringfield.com, as well as through your MySpace and Facebook pages and your Rick Springfield iPhone app. I know you got that documentary coming out next year, An Affair of the Heart, about your fan base. Anything and everything else that the people should know about, please take this chance and plug.
I'm happy just to plug the book. That's cool. There's going to be a lot more touring. We're getting already gearing up for next year, and there's going to be some TV stuff happening. And we're doing the Fox New Year's Eve show too.
Okay,
playing on that. But it's just really starting out in the new year, and I think it's going to be great.
Excellent. Well, it's been a very durable career, and you've broken out of Australia in a way that very few musical acts have really been able to do. So congratulations on everything. And with the book, we're holding it up to the camera here now, late at night, memoir here from Rick Springfield. Rick, it was a pleasure to have you on the program. You're welcome back anytime. Thank you very much.
Thanks, dude.
All right, appreciate it. Rick Springfield. And so we'll... we'll take our. You seem to take that the wrong way. My thing about when they write the obituary.
Yeah,
Paul,
I just was not, because I know you, Rick.
Yeah.
And when you say the obituary, you just pull stuff out of the air that just strikes me as funny, because I get your sense of humor. I get it, and I had tears coming out of my
when tears you of joy.
The,
I
tears
hope.
Of joy when you dropped the obituary line.
Oh, you know. You probably sensed I was going in a more caustic direction, but I played it straight.
Yeah, you did well.
Straight down the middle of the fairway.
Yeah, that's right.
It's we're courteous to our guests, and you know, again, it's a good message for kids. You know, if kids are trying to overcome something like this, I've seen him speak of this in some other interviews here. That hopefully there are lessons that can be drawn from that as far as how you go through and deal with something like this.
Yeah.